Thank you, Larry. And we're going to take some time for Q&A. So think of a question you might want to ask, and it doesn't have to be limited to the topic that Larry discussed here. He's obviously with 30 years with ICR, he's got a lot of knowledge, and so feel free to ask him any kind of question related to creation. And while you're thinking of that, we're going to do a free will offering, like I said. If you want to support this ministry, you'd like to see, you know, these speakers coming in, feel free to contribute either here or in the back. And also, some of the books that Larry mentioned, I should say, we do have a lending library. Come on forward. We do have a lending library, and that book, Thousands Not Billions, and also the DVD on that topic is also available if you want to just borrow that for a period of time. So, questions that you might have. Yeah.
I'd like to know a little bit about Dr. Vardaman's involvement with the RATE project. I think that's radioisotopes or in the age of the Earth. I'd like to know a little bit about that.
Okay.
In fact, he spoke on that very topic this morning for the students at Grace Academy.
Well, my involvement was kind of as the project administrator. I had the unique experience of being a project director for a major cloud seeding research project in Central California called the Skippy Project for the U.S. Bureau of Reclamation. And I learned how to spend a lot of money, get contractors, and coordinate research for that kind of a program. That was a multi-million dollar project as well. And in that experience, I was able to coordinate government employees, academic people, private companies, and which is an interesting challenge because you have different kinds of perspectives on things. But because of that experience, the Lord prepared me, I believe, to be able to begin or to initiate the RATE project. The RATE project was originally thought by the board members at ICR, particularly one of the members of the board, because he felt, and a number of people felt, that this was just the key issue that really bothered so many people. If you can't understand or explain at least somewhat the disagreement between billions of years and thousands of years, I mean, we got a factor of over a million there, we ought to be able to understand that somehow. So nobody had really ever, some individual young earth creationists had chosen to do that, but they'd never been able to solve it by themselves. And in some of them, they had actually shipwrecked their faith because they couldn't come up with a solution. So one of the things that we decided we needed to do was to put together a team to encourage one another and to sharpen each other. And when we went out to describe this to people, we got all kinds of good response, and we ended up raising over $2 million from the general Christian community to fund this project. ICR contributed about $500,000, but what was wonderful to see was the money came in as we needed it as it went along. And he also provided the insights and the concepts and the ideas, and provided the laboratories to do the work in, and the results were just fascinating. I mean, basically we found three major issues. One, we were able to show that coal had to be young, which is generally thought to be 100 million years old. We found that the zircons that are embedded in granite, in the biotite in granite, which is typically dated at 1.5 million or 2 million years old because of the uranium converting to lead at a very slow rate, when it also produces helium in that process, the helium was still there. And at the rate at which it diffuses out of the zircons in the rock, it shouldn't be there if the rock is that old. And we were able to actually get numbers for that to show that those zircons were 6,000 plus or minus 2,000 years old based on the helium. And then there was radio halos, which I don't want to get into. That's a bit complicated. But that also agreed that the rocks were young. So that project was extremely exciting. It was the first time a project of that scale was ever done. It's kind of the standard now. And there's other projects, particularly in genetics, where teams have been put together in young Earth creationist circles to do kind of research of that order. I might just say, as a final statement here, we've restarted that project because one of the deficiencies of the RATE project was that the information generally got out to the Christian community, but it didn't get adequately published in the conventional scientific community. Only in one circumstance did we report it at the American Geophysical Union meeting in San Francisco, and we got an incredible response there, but nobody believed it because they couldn't accept the idea. But they couldn't criticize our procedure. So we've decided that we're going to reinitiate this project, and we're going to get additional core samples. We're going to analyze it and attempt to report it in the conventional literature. Now, whether we'll be able to get that done is questionable, but we're going to take a shot at it. So we're in the process of raising funds for that now.
Yeah.
If the ocean temperatures went up to 120 degrees, what happened to the fish?
What happened to the fish? I always get that question. Very good. Well, first of all, let me get a drink here real quick. First of all, marine organisms, particularly clams and bottom dwellers, and fish, were the largest numbers of fossils you find anywhere on Earth. So there was tremendous numbers of them that were killed, probably cooked and then buried. But obviously, many of them survived. They didn't go in New York. They didn't have to. They could still live in the ocean. But there's two things that challenge them. One is, depending on whether the ocean was salty initially or not, could they handle the change in salinity? If it was not much salt in the ocean, that was mostly contributed by the flood, how were they able to handle the increase in salinity? Or if the ocean was salty or hot, how could they handle the heat? Well, there was all kinds of complexity during a catastrophic process. First of all, you had fresh rain falling like crazy. Water, fresh water, is lighter than salt water, so it tends to want to float on top of the salt water. So you probably had a layer of fresh water, relative cool water, laying on top of the oceans of the world. When the continents began to come back up, you had all this rain and snow on the continents falling and melting and running down the rivers into the oceans, forming lenses of fresh water over the ocean, and that water would have been cool coming off the continents in particular. So there were places that the fish could go which had different degrees of temperature and salinity where they could survive. So that's basically my explanation for that. And we have, by the way, we have very good evidence for these layers or these lenses of fresh water floating on the salt water. That happens anytime you have major floods going down the Mississippi. Though that water comes down and floats into the Gulf of Mexico and up the East Coast in the Gulf Stream. It's a layer of fresh water that tends to do that. And for example, even the Columbia River out here, when the water comes out the Columbia River, it goes out into the ocean for miles. Los Angeles has threatened to come up here with their tanker ships and take the water. They can't get it out of the river because it's all controlled. But out in the ocean, it's anybody's game out beyond 12 miles. They can get all the water they want and tank it to California.
We have other questions out there that take advantage of Larry being here to answer them.
Yeah, my question was the theory of the catastrophic plate tectonics. What was the major criticisms by the conventional science, and what were your, how'd you refute those or answer those?
You mean our comments at the American Geophysical Union meeting?
Right, yeah. What were their major criticisms or?
Yeah. Well, the comments, first of all, were they couldn't believe that young Earth creationists could do that kind of science. I mean, they were surprised. And they couldn't help but congratulate us on it and say, you need to do more of this work. Another comment from a fellow by the name of Dalrymple, who was the author of the book The Age of the Earth, which is kind of a classic in the field from radioactive dating techniques, took it upon himself to keep track of what young Earth creationists were doing in this area and report back to the American Association for the Advancement of Science at their annual meeting each year. And 1 year after we were beginning to report our results, he reported to them, he said to them, these guys, if they're right, these guys deserve the Nobel Prize. But they can't possibly be right, they're young Earth creationists. So that tells you something about the attitude. At the meeting where we presented the results, basically the comments were of extreme skepticism. This can't be right, can't be true, because it violates all the knowledge that we know. But some of them said, we'll go back and we'll test some of these in our own labs. We have at least one report back from one of those labs where they did that result, they did those tests, and they confirmed what we had found. Now, most of them didn't report back, and from the attitude that you have, you can understand why they probably didn't do that. But we, in the online literature, for about 5 years or more, we got a constant dialogue going between old Earth creationists and conventional scientists about this project, in which they criticized the techniques that we used. And Dr. Russ Humphreys spent probably a good 2 years of his life rebutting those questions and was able to completely refute every criticism that came along. So we feel very good about the whole result of that project. It just didn't get out to be a major piece of information to the scientific community, let alone the general world. Yes, sir.
Larry, for dummies like me, can you give just an elementary definition or description of, you mentioned that the core is solid, and then there's the molten, and then there's the crust.
Well, there's a mantle in between there, too. And it's kind of a hot plastic-like material.
Okay, so what, I guess, the understanding that heat rises, why is the core solid, and then the mantle and the crust, what's causing it to cool? Is that it? And then how does that work with, like, Kilauea? And then just as a quick secondary question, about 2 months ago, I read an article where we are due, we're like 50-100 years past due for a major tectonic shift that's supposed to cause a tsunami that'll take everything out from I-5 West. Okay. Do you know anything about that?
Yes, I do. Well, the thing that complicates this whole thing is that as you go down through the Earth's crust and mantle, you find different types of minerals, and they are solid. They are in solid form or liquid form, depending upon pressure and temperature, and that complicates this whole thing dramatically. So, for example, one of the things, there's a good likelihood that much of the water that came from the fountains of the deep was actually, by the shifting of the mantle and the lower crust, many of these minerals changed form, and they had connected with them water molecules, so that water molecules was released. One of the theories of the flood is that there were, at one time in the past, big lakes of water in the crust down deep in liquid form. But it is not necessarily needed, because much of that water could be tied up in the rocks themselves, and as it changes form, it releases the liquid water in the form of steam, which comes up and shoots and jets up into the atmosphere and so on. So to go beyond that, it's outside of my expertise, but it's a very complex situation down at those temperatures and pressures. In terms of the situation here west of I-5, there is the San Andreas Fault that runs up through California, off the coast of California there, just north of San Francisco at the Rays National Park. It's out under the ocean floor, and the further north you go up to this area here, it's about 75 miles off the coast out here, off the coastline, off the beach. And about 300 years ago, or a little more now, there was a major shift along that fault, just a standard earthquake, and it shifted, causing the one side of it to rise up and the other side to drop down, in addition to horizontal motions. And when that happens, it produces a tsunami. And the size of that tsunami was such that it wiped out almost all the Indian tribes all along the West Coast about 300 and some years ago. That apparently is overdue to happen again soon. Basically, when that happens, you hear that pop or you hear the rumble, you've got 15 minutes to get to high ground because it takes that long to get from 75 miles off the coast to the beach. And it's going to be big enough, possibly big enough, to go all the way to I-5 in places. Does that help? That doesn't help, does it?
Yeah. So get prepared.
That's why I live in Rockport.
Other questions people may have on this topic or any other creation topic? Okay, if not, I want to, again, Larry, thank you for your time here and for answering the questions, and you'll be available at the back after we break here, and people will want to ask you some more questions. Well, again, thank you for your interest in what we do here at the forum. We have a lot of interesting speakers planned coming. You know, Larry, of course, handled the geology, meteorology, and the atmosphere. Next month, we have the Dr. John Bile coming, and he's going to answer the question, is distant starlight a problem? And that's a question that many people have. You know, what about the starlight, the thousands of years of the age of the universe, and the star, yet light takes billions of years to get from some of those distant galaxies, supposedly, to get here. So John Bile is going to answer some of those questions for you. And he is an astronomer. He's retired now. He used to teach at the University of Trinity Western there up in Canada, up in BC. And so he's retired from there now, but he's still very active in speaking and researching on this topic. And then the next month we have somebody speaking on Lucy. Is Lucy real? You know, why is she still in our textbooks? Because she's been disproven as a transitional fossil. Well, what else are they looking for? And J.D. Mitchell is going to answer those questions. And then coming next year, we have some other interesting speakers that we're talking to answer some of these hard questions that you or your children at school may have asked. So keep that in mind as we go forward. In the back, again, we have...